Live. We are live, and anyone who has listened to us before, our plan is to do this regularly and do monthly recaps. But our plan is to do a little review of the year of 2020 today. So hopefully we'll have some good feedback from everyone. Hopefully we'll have a good discussion about the year that we've just had and maybe make a few predictions about where things are going. We thought it would be a really good idea, the two of us, because we have Bruno living as a Frenchman in California and Silicon Valley, me as a German living in London, England. So we should have most things covered here.
So ideally, we're able to cover everything that's happening throughout the year. And I think both our perspectives as immigrants, I guess, in the country probably give us a unique view of the news and what's happening in the data, AI, and analytics space.
Absolutely.
So this has been exciting.
So what a year it has been, right? I mean, this is, I think everyone has to acknowledge that this year has been horrific for many people, but it's also brought along so many changes. And for me, there's a real opportunity that we take some of this and make the world a better place going forward. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think one is it's been very sad and hard year for many of us having to change kind of the way we do things. I mean, luckily for people in technology, you know, what it changed is our habits, but for everyone else, it really changed their world in the ways that they are able to generate revenue for their family and so forth. And that's how I started my piece on Forbes this past week, where I talked about the difficulties, but also what it is that we have learned from it. And what can we do moving forward? And certainly the acceleration of digitalization has been probably the only thing that's been really positive about what we're going through. It's also, I think, helped many of us think about how do we want to go back to work? When we go back to work, what does the normal look like? It's difficult to imagine that we'll ever go back to something like what we had in the past, either because we have developed habits that to some extent they might be beneficial moving forward. I see companies thinking about having their employees go back to work, but maybe 3 days a week instead of the whole week. And certainly the way restaurants and businesses are going to operate, I think they'll go through ways where they'll have a lot more flexibilities in how they're running their business. So that's some of the things to look forward to. Certainly in the technology world, I talked in this last piece about the trend around augmented everywhere, as well as composite applications, which I think if you're a CIO in the enterprise, that's something you want to pay attention to. Particularly this last one, you and I have talked about augmentation everywhere. And we're going to talk today about bias and how humans can help machines kind of reduce their bias. But the composite application trend, which was started by Gartner, I think just a few months ago, is an interesting one in the sense that when more people inside your organization take advantage of low-code and no-code platforms to build applications, what does that do to the applications you are used to in the past? What does that do to the CRM and the ERP applications that were running your business a certain way, and now you might have a business analyst in a marketing organization that's building an application that does just about everything he or she needs in order to manage and predict the types of leads that they want to feed into the sales organization. So I think you'll see a lot of that moving forward, how development of applications is becoming more agile, combined with cloud first and AI services available to just about anyone, so you can assemble them and build powerful purpose-built applications. It's going to create a challenge for the IT organization, how they manage that, of course, but it might create interesting applications that we were not used to seeing in the past.
I completely agree. So for obviously this year for me, coronavirus pandemic has changed our world completely and has forced businesses to digitally transform, because they, and lots of different people have different views, but what I have seen is 2, 3, 4, 5 years sometimes of digital transformation taking place in a matter of a few months, just because of necessity, where suddenly people had to work from home, we had to find digital ways to engage with our customers, digitizing the supply chains and so on. So for me, this is the number one story out of this year. And this has given rise, you talk about augmenting everything, it's creating a hybrid world in the future where we are working from home, but in a hybrid way. So at the moment, we're working from home fully, but in the future, we will find the right balance. And for me, in some of my prediction articles I've recently published, I talk about working from home 2.0. Because it's a bit like we've now all had to do it. But if anyone is really honestly looking at the situation across the country, across the world, there are lots of people that work from home on their kitchen table. They haven't got a comfortable desk. They haven't got necessarily the fast internet connection. They haven't got the all laptops for everyone. And I feel extremely lucky. I have a home office. I've always worked from home. My kids can carry on with their education. So for me, working from home is a really important trend where every business now has to really reflect on how they will make this work in the future. And really figuring out what is good about working from home and when is it good to be in the office and what is the right balance for this.
I mean, certainly in areas in the US, I'll tell you, in Silicon Valley and the East Coast and New York, where we used to say location, location, location really mattered where you lived. I think this also is going to have an impact on the real estate market in areas that tend to be overpopulated, where people moved because they had to move for their jobs. Now they're going to have a lot more flexibility. I mean, certainly in Silicon Valley, we see people that are not from here. I see someone is from Austin listening to us. And so I was talking to someone this week who is, he's got his entire family in Texas and moved to Silicon Valley for his job. Mm. Doesn't really need to do that anymore. And they can travel to the corporate office if they need to have meetings, but they've developed a good habit and the rest of the organization is starting to embrace this idea that you'll have a lot of remote work. And so I think it's going to create flexibility for folks. It's going to change the mix in real estate for sure. There still, I think, will be gravity towards the headquarters of some of these large organizations because there's nothing like in-person meetings. It's really hard. The thing that I haven't seen yet is the explosion in technology like collaborative whiteboards and other ways where we can try to emulate. I'd love to be able to whiteboard like I would do in a meeting room and have someone across the world whiteboard with me. I think there's more opportunities there. I mean, sure, we saw the explosion of Zoom and other platforms for what we're doing here. But I think there's more that we can expect to see from a consumer standpoint. From an enterprise standpoint, the thing that I have not seen yet, and wonder what you think about this, is the acceleration of AI going into production. I saw Forrester this past week, you know, downgrade their forecast on AI adoption. They used to forecast that the AI market would be $150 billion, and now they've downgraded that to $37 billion now. And that's still a lot. It's still a big market. So it's not a huge downgrade, but it is, I think, talking to the issues of going from proof of concept to production. And I know you write a lot about that and you consult with organizations. So what do you see are the issues with getting from a proof of concept into a production state? And what are companies that are doing it the best, what are they doing?
Yeah, so for me, this is a very good point. And this is something I see across so many businesses. And I think one of there are a number of reasons why organizations are not moving fast into real production of AI. Too many stay at the pilot phase. They have too many pilots. And for me, the key is to approach this strategically and actually plan for success. This is something that I don't actually see in lots of AI projects. They start as little pet projects. They start as let's experiment, let's look at some of the low-hanging fruits instead of actually really approaching it strategically with the right buy-in, the executive sponsorship, and then everything else that comes with good execution where you say, okay, what are we expecting to see in terms of success? Can we link this to our business goals, our KPIs? Can we then put a proper program in place? Can we address some of the skills issues, some of the cultural issues, and so on? And this is something I don't see happening very well.
But a lot of what I've read in terms of the areas where people struggle, it really is about the technology. It's about how you organize your teams and how they communicate. I published best practices I found from companies like Netflix, for instance, or Spotify. I guess in Europe, I don't know how many folks are familiar with Spotify. It's interesting. It's a European company, but it's very popular in the US. I think there are other services in Europe, but where they build these teams around data and operationalization of data, which ties to another trend from Gartner, where they're saying the data scientist role is actually going to be overridden by the machine learning engineer the machine engineering role is going to grow by a factor of 5x in the next few years. So I think that's an interesting trend, because if you combine this with the composite app trend and the fact that more people are going to become machine learning, you know, specialists, what's going to happen to the fabric or the organization of our teams? I was talking to a customer earlier this week and I was saying, how did you accelerate the production of your data projects? And they said, we did two things. We had a central team, and we also embedded machine learning engineers inside the business. And so they used this hybrid kind of deployment, not for the technology, but for their people organization. But I think that's going to be a challenge of how do you go from these pet projects to something where the technology is mature and the org chart is mature enough so you can embrace and then operationalize your AI data analytics projects.
Yeah, I completely agree. Just going back to some of the earlier discussion about working from home, how many will people carry on working from home, and to what extent? So what's your prediction? I mean, you work for Google. What's the feeling inside Google at the moment?
I think, you know, if I look at certainly the technology space, I think a large portion of us, I'm talking for the Silicon Valley, not just for Google, but just for my community, it is easy to believe that a large majority, so more than 50%, would be able to just work from home and still be fairly effective. I know in my line of work, I really enjoyed meeting people in person, and I think it's just really difficult to emulate. And so I certainly think that I don't think that I will go up to 50%. I'll probably go to 30%. So maybe, 2 days or a day and a half per week where you can work from home. And maybe you take that day as a no meeting day or something like this, where you go into the office Monday and Tuesday, you take Wednesday where you dedicate it to work, and then you go back Thursday and Friday for more in-person meetings. I think that for me, that would be the ideal. Now, it also depends on the type of business you're in. I think if you're in places where realistically you don't need to be in person to brainstorm with others and so forth, it could be more than 50%. I still think that when we go back progressively to hopefully being safe, I think people will want to see people in 3D again. I can't wait to meet people I work with in person. I feel like
I can't wait for the both of us to explore some more French restaurants.
Exactly. Yeah. Last time we were in London, it feels like an eternity ago, but
I know.
Yeah.
I know. And so for me, there's work 2.0 relates to all the other areas that we're seeing. So I'm seeing the same transition happening in education at the moment. Obviously, I've got 3 children, but 2 of them are working from home at the moment and remotely, and this seems to be working quite well. And so this will be interesting to see how much of the education side. I can't see a short-term change there, because I believe people will just go back to normal classroom. But there's a big opportunity. Whereas in health, for example, I see a big push towards more digital, and that will hopefully carry on, where you can have consultations with your doctor over Zoom, and there's been a huge uptake. And events, I think that's another area. This is an area where I spent my life traveling the world doing keynotes at events, and I'm enjoying the fact that I don't have to travel all the time now. And I think it's good for me.
Yeah.
The health is good for our world and for the environment and everything else.
So yeah, I think if you break down each of these areas are kind of interesting. Like healthcare, I do agree with you that I think it's safer. It's more effective if I could get a consultation from my doctor remotely. I think it's better for them. It's better for me, especially if I'm sick or if the last patient they saw was sick. So it's just going to prevent contamination. And there's technology now that allows to be fairly effective. On events, I agree with you. One of the things I noticed is the quality of the presentations actually, I feel, has gone up, because it forces people to communicate in a shorter format. By being remote, they might be able to maybe look up their notes more. I'm not sure what's going on, but the events that I've been part of, the sessions are no longer 60 minutes because of the online format doesn't allow you to do that as much. So you're starting to see in 20, 35 minutes, really strong content coming at people where I feel like I'm learning. On education, I don't know what to believe. I'd be curious to see what people feel. I have two kids as well that are studying at home, one in college and one in high school. And I feel bad because I feel like a lot of why you go to school for is learning to kind of be yourself in civilization. And so they're definitely losing that. And then I noticed that, you know, the 16, 18 year olds, I've started to develop a habit of looking at multiple screens at the same time. So I'm worried about this low attention syndrome that it's going to create a habit for as they become adults. I mean, I see it, we'd be watching a movie together. It's easy for them to pull their phone. And I'm afraid that they might do that at school. So while they're studying to their, they're listening to their teacher, it's easy to pull up the phone and do something in multitasking. And I think research has shown that multitasking is really doesn't exist. It's not really effective. So I'm a little bit afraid of that.
Yeah. So
it's in the education world, I'm worried that this is going to create bad habits for our kids.
Yeah. In our house, we have a one screen rule. So for example, if we're all sitting together and watching a movie or watching TV, we are only allowed to have one screen, which we're all watching, and no one is going on their mobile phones.
Oh, that's good. I might steal that. This week, it's funny you're mentioning rules like this. This week, a friend of mine was making a decision of, do I get my 11-year-old a phone? Because she was asking for it. And so we were talking about it. And I remembered when my first child asked for a phone, we actually drew a contract for her with rules like this. We will have passwords into your phone. You will say things in using your phone that you think is fair, that you would only be comfortable if you said it in person. Like, we came up with a set of rules, and this one screen rule could actually be one that I will use certainly for my family. I think it's a good one. It's an easy one for anyone to implement to make sure your kids don't become a low attention.
Yes. So for me, there's figuring out how we do things better in the future. Healthcare, education, working, retail is another area that I think is transforming massively at the moment. And finding digital channels. And I'm quite excited about virtual reality, augmented reality, especially in the retail space, where it will make a big difference, I think, over the next few years.
Certainly augmented reality in the retail space is it's huge potential there. I haven't been in a store to try clothes in months at this point, but I have bought this jacket. Like, you could try it, you can see it for fit, and it's a lot more effective than trying something, not liking it, returning it. I mean, I think it has all the benefits of making the relationship between you and the retail a lot more effective for their inventory and for the logistics systems required to take care of returns and everything else around it. What about books of the year? What are your favorite books this year? You write a lot of books yourself. but I'm curious what you read.
Yeah, so I read basically everything that talks about technology, about data, about AI, and I'm not sure there's one that really stands out this year for me, but I've read all of them, and I try to get a good balance. I now also do lots of audiobooks. So I use the time as I go running, for example, when I drive to different places. I don't tend to drive a lot at the moment because there's nowhere to go. But running, I get through probably a book a week just by running, and then I would read physical books too. How about you? Have you had any?
I try, you know, it's just like you. I don't really have a hobby. My hobby is technology and data and analytics. And so I find that even the books that I pick up have something related to decision-making theories and anything. The one I came across that's recent is this one here. It's on my desk. I'm about halfway through it, is this book, the Barack Obama book, The Promised Land. And the reason for why I like this book, it's not a political book. It's a book about decision making. He just started a blog on Medium on how to make tough decisions. And if you think about any of us who's making some of the toughest decisions, certainly the president is a great example. And so this is one of my favorite books this year. I also reread this book. I don't know if I talked to you about it previously, but this is an interesting one. How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big by Scott Adams. So if you know Scott Adams, he is the author of Dilbert, and he's very active on social as well. He talks about how to use information to create a win-win situation where if you're wrong, you're right. And if you're right, you're right. And so I guess maybe it's my own bias. When I read these books, I always think about how they can relate to the industry I've been passionate about for multiple decades. But this one is particularly funny.
I agree with you, I think, on the Obama book, I think.
On the Obama book, she's at the chapter 11. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. So yeah, I'm not there yet because it's a big book and it's his first book I'm hearing, right? So there are two of these that are coming. And I'm French, like I said earlier. So my mom got this book in French. And so we're reading it together. And it's kind of interesting. I also got it just like you do, Bernard. I got it on audio. So when I bike or when I run, it's nice. And on the audio piece, he actually is the one reading it. So he has a great voice. And so it's great to hear his voice talk about his book and this kind of his experience through the going
he,
to
he's
his
reading it himself. That's very impressive.
Yes, I think it's there aren't many authors that do that. Another book that I read this year is called Never Split the Difference. It's about this hostage negotiator, Chris Voss, who talks about how to negotiate for what you want. And he has a great voice. I came across the author through a masterclass that he had available. It's called Masterclass. I have it on my phone. And it's one of the most interesting courses there. So I was watching it and I said, okay, I'm going to check out the guy's book. And the book's really great. And he has a great voice, but he is not reading his book, which I think is just a shame because just like the Barack Obama book, you get so much by listening to this very dark and very strong voice, especially when you know it from the author.
Great speaker. I mean, I don't do my own books because I literally haven't got the time to do it. And I'm currently recording an online course on data strategy. And this is taking me a long time just to record, do the voiceover. So I simply couldn't do this for my book, I think.
Oh, especially, I mean, it'd be tens of hours. You know, my first book, Drive Business Performance, is the same. We had an audio version of it. I could not imagine having to reread myself like that. Plus, I think with my accent, it would be a terrible experience for people. So I prefer to have a professional. And they're good, like the exactly. Folks that are hired by the publishing companies, they do a really good job. So someone saying that they listened and they read this year, Never Split the Difference. Yeah, it's a great book. And if you get a chance to watch Chris Voss online, he's got a few YouTube talks, he's got a TED talk. He's really funny.
I just remembered one of the books that I've recently finished that I really liked, which is Think for Yourself. Is Harvard
Business. Oh, I don't know this one.
I'm not even starting to try to pronounce his name because it's very complicated, but Think for Yourself is a great book. I think it is really related to the topic we're talking about because it's all about in this new world of AI and big data, how do you actually think for yourself and don't just rely on algorithms and experts and have some critical thinking, which also links me to another important trend, I think, that we've seen this year. We obviously had the US election, which was a big event this year. And what I found quite disturbing is the amount of fake news and misinformation that was spread by the campaign. And for me, this is something where we need more people that can actually think for themselves. This is why I think this book is important. We need to have people that have critical thinking skills and think, okay, where's this information coming from? I can't just take anything that people put on Twitter for as truth. And there's so much misinformation and actually campaigns that are designed to spread misinformation and fake news. And for me, this is very important. This starts with, I think, our entire political landscape, but it also goes into the tech world. We've had this campaign and misinformation around 5G, for example. We have the political fight between China and America, for example, where we are talking about potentially banning apps like TikTok and companies like Huawei. And it would be nice if one of the things, one of the shimmers of hope that I'm seeing is that there are more and more apps now available that can actually fact check things. So a bit like what Twitter did with some of the tweets that Donald Trump put out there, saying actually they're actually incorrect. that we want to highlight this. And I hopefully we'll have a bit more help from AI to help us see through some of the misinformation.
Yeah, it's really tough. So I'm going to look into that book. The minute you talked about that, that's a really great title too, Think for Yourself. I think the issue with this topic of fake news and the perspective is as much as a technology problem as the human issue. And what I mean by that is being open to try and listen to, quote unquote, the other side. My daughter found this series. I'll try to pull it up on YouTube, where it brings two groups of complete opposite views on a topic, and it gets them to debate. And you listen to this and you start realizing that, you know, we have different perspectives. It's kind of reading a newspaper that's completely to the right, a newspaper that's completely to the left. It's a complete different interpretation of what reality is. I certainly do this. I watch a lot of news, and sometimes I wish I wasn't as addicted to news that I was, because I think it would make my blood levels a lot more stable. But what I try to do is I try to listen to local, not local, but news networks from the US, but I also listen to the French news. So I have this program I go to, it's 7 minutes every day. I listen to France 24. So it gives me an outside perspective. And then every once in a while, I go and listen to channels that I don't listen to, and I know are typically listened to by people that are not of the same political views as I am. And it gives you perspective. And it's a hard exercise because sometimes you might be upset, but I think the risk, particularly when it comes to news and information, is to be narrow focused in one view and get confirmation bias, that kind of like the horoscope, right? You're just set on the view, and then you're hearing information every day that is confirming your view. And if we learn anything, I think, in decision making, is the way to make better decisions is not to be narrow, is to expand the choices and expand the perspectives on the data itself. And there's another book here, I'll try to pull it up, from the Heath brothers.
This is a very good point, which also this whole bias that we are seeing, because what we're talking about data and AI and a lot of stuff we do for our work. And obviously AI is very good at personalizing information. So they're feeding us the news, and they're learning what we like and our views, and they're doing the same on TikTok and the same on Instagram and Facebook. And these create these filter bubbles where AIs are becoming so good that they're serving you the same kind of information. I think this is part of the problem, that there are certain people that watch the same news channels all the time, that read the same websites, that have the same conversations with each other, and they all believe that this is how the world is. And I'm the same. I'm trying to get the outside perspective. I read the German news. I try to read the international news. I always look at the European news. I look at the US news. And for me, this is absolutely important. And I'm surprised of how biased or how blinkered the views are sometimes. Even when I look at the news here in the UK, they are so massively big. Yeah. One of the biggest problems I've found with this whole, the pandemic we're going through at the moment, is that instead of actually coordinating things internationally, it seems like everyone reverts back to their own country, to their own problems. Everyone is trying to sort out by themselves, which I find really frustrating.
Yeah, I found the book that I was referring to by Chip Heath. So we refer to them here as the Heath brothers, because they're both professors at Stanford, just down the street from me. And they wrote this book called Decisive, How to Make Better Choices in Life and Work. This is another book I would suggest, because it breaks down, you know, the science of decision making. And one of, I think there's five lessons in the book, if I remember correctly. One of the lessons is, when you're confronted with an opinion on a fact, is expand the horizon. Think to the right, think to the left, and try to include more views and data points, so you're not too narrow in your decision making. Same thing kind of connects a little bit with the negotiation book by Chris Voss, which is often when you're having to negotiate, you realize that the issue is not you and the person, it's this problem that together we could collaborate to go and solve. And so I would recommend this book, Decisive. There's another book that's coming up by Dan Heath, one of the two brothers, called Upstream, the quest to solve problems before they happen. I've not read this book. This one looks interesting. It just came out in March 2020. And so that's another one. Often, you know, we're wired to react and we don't think about, okay, what are the leading factors we could be looking at that indicate where the future is going. And so if you don't know the Heath brothers, this is a good pair to follow.
We touched on biases and filter bubbles. And for me, there are bigger biases and actually biases that potentially lead to inequalities as well. I think if we look back at the year that we've just had, another major movement was the Black Lives Matter movement that we've seen across the world that has obviously highlighted inequalities and discrimination. What we're seeing out in this world is that we seem to be getting a lot of this. We see digital divides, we're seeing increasing gaps between the people, the wealthy and the poor. We see, and all of this has real implications for technology, has real implications for our world. Technology on the one hand side can help with this. It can actually reduce biases, but I think we need to be aware of this. And this always leads me back to actually having this critical thinking and having processes in place in our organizations to spot biases. I had an interesting discussion recently with a professor where we talked about the ethical uses of AI. And one of the problems is that very often AI algorithms and data sets are biased in a similar way that humans are biased or information is biased in the world. So we've seen this with the vaccines. I think there are lots of populations that are underrepresented in the COVID vaccine trials, for example, or there are algorithms that where certain demographics are underrepresented, be male, female, and anything, certain
identities.
And this for me is another really important thing that we need to watch out in the future to think about: how do we reduce this? How do we use technology for good? And how do we make sure that people in organizations are aware that lots of data we rely on at the moment to train our algorithms might be biased?
I mean, you've got a lot in what you just said here. I think the first one is this aspect of technology and making sure that brings us together, doesn't, you know, increase the divide, right, where the richer get richer and the poor get poorer. I think certainly in this COVID crisis, we saw that if you're a minority, you're getting increasingly affected by the crisis disproportionately to other parts of the population. So really, this is a big problem, I think, to solve. On the bias on AI, you know, it ties to the trend that we talked about earlier. We tend to talk about augmented everywhere, and the first thought that people have is that, oh my gosh, this is now machines automating just about everything a human does. But I think if you read what augmented everywhere means, is it also works the other way, which is humans making sure that the way we're using algorithms doesn't go out of control. And so I like to think about augmented in both directions. Augmented where, yes, there are tasks that are repetitive, highly predictable, binary in their decision-making process, which machines can do better, faster than humans can do. But there are tasks that machines can do as well as humans, and this idea of judgment and applying critical thinking, just like you said earlier, think for yourself, is where humans can add to machines as well. I think that there's a lot of work being done in this field. Another book I could think of is Tom Davenport, I think, wrote this book called Only Humans May Apply, or something like this. I'll pull up the title, which talks about this divide and when is a task appropriate for a machine, when is a task appropriate for humans, and where are our tasks where we help each other. I don't know that we have the answer to it, but it's certainly, I think, continuing to talk about it, continuing to build that into how we build our systems, and also how we perceive reality. I think the issue of deepfake is a big one that worries me a lot, especially as we perceive what reality is. And so I think it's part of the problem of technology, but it's also part of the problem of, as humans, we have to keep reminding ourselves to get out of our bubble. It's just very tempting and very easy to just get news from one source, fall kind of prey to your own confirmation bias. By the way, as we're talking, I asked my daughter, I texted her, I asked her what the series that she's looking at that is giving both sides of an issue together. And it's a YouTube series called Middle Ground, where they bring people that have complete different opposite views of a topic, and they'll debate for 30 minutes on it. And it's interesting to watch because you understand the why. It doesn't matter what side of the issue you're in. It shows you why people are thinking a certain way, but it also shows you that there are people just like you, which is, I think, what we need to remember every time is we're all humans. The problem is really each other. The problem is that we should be solving together as humans.
Absolutely. Very good. What are some of your future predictions then, looking ahead to 2021 and beyond? How would you summarize some of the things that we as people have to prepare ourselves for and as businesses?
I think the big one for me is this low code, no code, this changing ecosystem. I think I'm thinking about the enterprise trend first. If you're at a company today and if you have not taken a look at that trend, I would, because I think that if you're in marketing or if you're in sales, you have been used to using CRM systems that are built a certain way and that bring you down this particular path of decision making. And certainly over the last 10 years, we're starting to see limitations of it. In fact, if you look at the MarTech, what's called the MarTech, the marketing technology stack, I think 8 years ago, there's only a few hundreds of vendors in that space. And now there's 8,000 companies providing services into that industry. And why are they doing that? Is because the monolithic box of the CRM world are just limited. And now we need more. We need intelligence. It's not about knowing which accounts you're selling into and the leads related to it. It's now there's so much information. There's so many of those leads. You need to be able to identify propensity of certain people to buy. You need to be able to use cohort analysis to be able to identify accounts and people that look the same so you can offer services that are appropriate to them so you don't spam and overwhelm folks. And so I think this evolution of intelligent applications and the infrastructure supporting building those low-code AI services and cloud that's very affordable for any of us to use as a platform to build will change. I think in 10 years from now, when you and I talk, I think we'll be surrounded by a different set of applications. And so certainly if you're an employee of a company using these systems today, I would look at how they're going to change. And if you're in the business of creating your own company, I think it's never been easier to create your company by assembling these services. The challenge today is not so much, can we build it? It's should we build it? Because the tooling is here. So I think that's the trend to me that is going to change the landscape for the CIO in the next 10 years for sure.
Yeah, and this is very closely aligned to a trend that I've been talking about, which is this whole push towards this as a service economy, where whether we're talking about apps or anything, software applications, data storage, everything is now available as a service. And even if you wanted to use big data analytics and artificial intelligence or even a robot, you can now go to companies like Honda and say, I would like you to deliver a robot to me that should work in this warehouse, perform these tasks. And you don't even have to buy this. They will come to you, they will program the robot, it will then work, and you basically rent it. And this will transform so many other aspects of our lives, I think, where we have this as a service push, where it changes ownership to some extent. I don't believe that in the future we will be buying cars and phones or make very few capital investments, and everything will be available as a service. And I think for companies, they need to really think about this whole new hybrid augmented world and say, okay, how can we actually deliver a great service to our customers to solve their problems? And thinking about this from a customer perspective, I think this is something lots of the big companies I work with, this is something that they sometimes don't do. They don't think about the customer problem they're trying to solve, and they think about themselves mm-hmm. as a product company, a service company. So I've seen this in automotive, for example, where they think we are making cars, and in the future, okay, we are now pushing towards electricity, electric cars, and so on. But actually what they're providing is a service to get you from A to B, and this will change in the future, where we will have different solutions that will do this. And I love working with areas like Dubai, where they're now having a commercial autonomously flying drone taxi service available, where you're ordering an Uber on your phone, you're ordering a drone that will take you home. And once you start thinking about this problem you're trying to solve, I think you can come up with really innovative solutions.
You know, this is really interesting. I did not know about the Dubai story, but I certainly think that you're absolutely right. And the last 10 years has showed us that the meaning of owning something has changed dramatically, certainly in the world of music. I don't think I own a record anymore. I have access to subscription, and if I stop paying for it, all that goes away. But I don't think about ever canceling that, because it now I'm not buying a subscription. I'm buying kind of the service and the value proposition. Reminds me, when I was in school, we would do these case studies of what we call the job of a company. What business are you in? And we would talk about Disney, for instance. What business are they in? Are they in the business of producing a movie, or are they in the business of entertainment? Which now, if you know, in the business of entertainment and enjoyment, now that makes sense, because that's why you have parks and that's why you have other things that are not related to this physical thing. So pushing the leaders of a company to really think about what is the value proposition you're bringing and what business you're in is a great one. I mean, you're a car manufacturer. You're not in the business of building cars. Yes, that's what you do. But the value you bring to folks is the frictionless transportation, the ability to see their families, friends, and go to work effectively. And so there are many ways you can provide the service. And certainly, I do agree with you and believe that owning a physical car ultimately will not be something we want to do, either because economically it won't make sense. And I have an electric car myself. I haven't brought it into the shop and since I bought it, because there's no point to do it. I mean, they become more effective themselves. So I'll just pay a monthly, and maybe I don't need to park either. Maybe the car can come pick me up. And then for the same price of owning it, I don't have to look for parking. I don't have to worry about maintenance. And what it delivers is it takes me from this point to that other point.
The real potential to change the landscape in our cities. At the moment, we have driveways, we have garages, and I don't believe that in the future we will need that. Now, this is a topic for a different discussion. Quantum computing in the next 5 years, that's interesting. It's definitely a trend that I'm watching very, very closely.
This is a big one.
Yeah.
This is a big one. I feel we're just at the beginning. There are certainly many companies that are talking about it, evangelizing it, but I think it's an interesting trend to watch now, because you're just at the beginning of the potential of what this technology can do. I have a really good friend who's in this field and has been studying it for many years at this point. And you've got some conferences you can go to and some books you can read about it. You don't see a lot of applications for it because the infrastructure required, the type of hardware that's required is kind of unique, but it's certainly, and it's kind of like being at the beginning of regular computing 20 years ago. And certainly there, with the advent of quantum computing over not just the next 5 years, I think this is the kind of trend that's just going to accelerate in on itself. I think you'll start seeing breakthrough in the next 2 to 3 years in areas that we just, you know, couldn't even imagine before. That's one thing that I've learned, at least in the area that I work in, is when the technology changes itself, it also creates an amazing potential for us to think about things that we didn't think were possible before. And a great example in the data world is, in the past, our ability to ask questions was really limited by how much the data we could actually store. And now that storage is really no longer a problem. Now that getting answer to a question happens in milliseconds rather than sometimes in, you know, hours, you end up asking more questions. Sometimes they're the wrong question, but asking, the cost of asking more questions has gone down to zero. And so I think when you do that, you are bound to find the right question. And when you're bound to find the right question, you're going to find the right answer. And so you're going to be able to advance a lot faster. So I'm looking forward for technologies like this to really break through, because it's going to take us in places that we can't even imagine we could get to today.
I completely agree. And I don't see huge advances taking place over the next year or two in terms of quantum computing. but over the next 5 years, potentially, especially when you think about this as a service movement that I've talked about before, because you can then have quantum computing as a service and companies, you can already have this today, which is pretty cool. Do we see 2 or 3 internets? Unfortunately, I think this is where things are going at the moment. What I'm seeing is that there's this splintering of internet and apps and clouds in the US. We see this in Asia, around China, and in Europe, potentially Russia. So that is a trend that I don't think anyone wants, but I think it's happening, because we have different economies, different ways people look at privacy, different views of how much the state is able to control some of the data and use it, and because there are major differences across the world at the moment, I see the splintering just accelerating at the moment.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's not something I actually have been paying attention to much. Maybe it's just because most of my work is in the US, and so I look at it from that lens, but that's really interesting that I'll look into more for next month, because that's going to be quite concerning in how we look at the world if we have multiple views into it.
Great. Physical filter bubbles on top of the AI-enabled ones.
Yeah, exactly.
I think initially our plan was to talk for half an hour. We are now almost an hour. That was one of the things that Bruno and I are going to do in the future is to do this regularly. And our plan is to do this every last Friday of the month. And I would love to hear what you think about this. Do you think it's a good idea? Do you enjoy these sessions? Because literally these are not prepared. We basically sit down and saying, let's talk about the year. And we basically logged on 10 minutes, had a quick chat, and then we went on. But I personally feel that these really work well, and we always have a really engaging discussion. So let us know what you think, and if there are any specific topics you want us to talk about in the future. And then we will start planning these from January onwards, and every month we'll have a session.
I feel like we could talk for hours. So talking to you every month is a fun thing to look forward to for me, for sure.
Very good. Okay. Thank you so much. I hope you have a restful, peaceful Christmas and a good start to the new year. And everyone else listening has the same. You get a little bit of a break over the holidays and an enjoyable start to the new year that will hopefully see us win the battle with the global pandemic, and hopefully we will tackle all the bad bits and take all the good bits that we've seen this year, and hopefully create a world that is better than it was.
That's right. Have a great break, and then we will see you in January.
Very good. Thank you very much.